This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I have to take the compliment, but man, I hate the Red Sox.
And now, here's your host, Daniela Fairchild.
Hello, this is your host, Daniela Fairchild of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net, filling in for Mike Petrilli, for he is at yet another beach on vacation in another undisclosed location. He's probably never coming back. That said, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Boston Red Sox of education policy, Dara Z. Handelar.
Why am I the Boston Red Sox?
Gosh, don't sound so excited about it. Because they're my favorites.
I have to take the compliment, but man, I hate the Red Sox.
No one can hate the Red Sox. Well, mostly the entire country can hate the Red Sox. But I can hold them near and dear to my heart. Don't worry, though. We have the All-Star break upon us. The Red Sox are sure to come apart at the seams now. We have had our time. We are Icarus.
Whereas my Dodgers slowly working their way out of the cellar, which is a change for us because usually at All-Star break, we're like one or two games in first, which doesn't mean much in the National League West. But anyway, and then we use the All-Star break to begin a slow decline into mediocrity where maybe we make the playoffs and then get beaten by the Phillies and then we're done. So hopefully, cross your fingers, my Dodgers are not going to do that this year.
Pull a 1969 Mets.
Yeah, right. Haven't won the World Series since 1988. Haven't even come close.
On that note, it's time to play Pardon the Gadfly. Pamela, take us away.
According to a New York Post survey, the Big Apple's transfer high schools, the city's schools of last resort for struggling teens, saw 78 more students drop out than graduate in the 2011-2012 academic school year. To compare, last year at the same school, 619 more students graduated than dropped out. What's going on?
So, Dara, this is actually an interesting point. We have a couple different things happening. First is what's going on in New York. And there's debate about whether this is a policy shift issue that mid-year changes to graduation requirements are affecting grad rate numbers, or if Regents tests, which are getting scored a little bit differently, are affecting grad numbers. But then on the larger issue, we have this concept of credit recovery and these dropout, you know, sort of programs, and whether they're even meant to be programs that have 75-80% graduation rates.
Right. And I think, you know, to the first issue, what's going on in New York? Yes, this year, 78 more students dropped out than graduate. Last year, you had a lot more students graduate than drop out. Did something change? Is it a fundamental shift? Are we just talking about 1 year of data that's not indicative of a trend? Who's to say? But I think that it draws attention to a very important larger issue, which are these credit recovery or dropout recovery schools, where you're talking about students who are severely credit deficient. Let's say they are 18 years old. They should be in the 12th grade, but they only have as many high school credits as a 9th or 10th grader. So what do? You put them in these transfer schools. You sometimes accelerate their credit-bearing courses, or they take multiple courses at the same time. They enroll in night school, basically bumping up their credits so that they can graduate. And by definition, these schools are going to have high dropout rates because these are students who have already dropped out of high school once or twice before. They are 1 or 2 or 3 years behind in terms of credits. And whatever was going on in their lives that created that situation likely hasn't changed. So advocates of these types of schools would say the fact that any students graduated from them is an accomplishment, and it shouldn't speak to the quality of, it shouldn't indicate a poor quality school. The other argument is that by putting students into these credit recovery academies, you're creating a diploma factory, and that you're just cranking them through courses, you're giving them credits, you're giving them a diploma, and the education that they receive is not necessarily high quality. In New York, that might not be the case, though, because you have to take tests in order to get your diploma.
Well, then there's the other, I want to give a shout out to a friend of mine's school and then bop back to a previous point you made, in that there are some transfer schools in New York that are not these dropout recovery programs. HMI, the Henrik Martin Institute, is a school for students who have been bullied, predominantly LGBT community students, who can't, you know, access the curriculum in the same way and feel safe doing it. And so it goes, so there are transfer schools in New York that aren't these dropout recovery program type things. That said, back to another point you made, I go back and forth on this. Advocates of credit recovery programs, sure, can say, you know, we've got a 40% graduation rate or a 25% graduation rate. That's better than nothing. At the same time, we shouldn't accept better than nothing as quality for these students. And it should be, you know, we should be a little upset about the fact that we're seeing a lower grad rate. Whether if it's 1 year, okay, and it's a blip on the radar, but if it's a trend down, or if we're still just at a low grad rate, we really should be thinking about ways to make these programs worthwhile and not just, as you said, and not just, you know, mills to give them credits and pump them on their way.
Which goes back to something that Fordham repeats over and over and over, which is you can have multiple pathways to academic success as long as you have accountability.
Excellent point. All right, Pamela, question number two.
The California State Board of Education plans to discuss adopting the next generation science standards next fall. Several board members have already expressed support for the proposed standards. Should California adopt?
That's a really bold question, Pamela. I mean, we've been towing this line on offering cogent information while simultaneously not telling states whether or not to adopt standards. I will say that California standards, by our own 2012 report, received a perfect score, a 10 out of 10, an A, top scores in the nation, and have had some of the strongest standards on record over the past 12 years. Or plus, it was 1998 that they adopt their standards, so a couple more than 12. That said, California's student achievement has not followed suit with its standards. It has super quality standards, but achievement is still middling at best. And so really, whether California wants to adopt the NJSS or not has little to do with the standards itself, in my opinion, and really more about what they're going to do with their standards. You know, we can buy California a new dress, but if it doesn't leave the house, California's never going to be the prom queen.
I like that metaphor. I mean, should California adopt? I don't know. But I think that what they're going to have to do is weigh the adoption of new standards against the pros and cons of changing from the system that they already have. Whether or not they agree that their current standards are better than NGSS, that's up to them. We say so, but that's up to them. However, transitioning to a new set of standards is a huge endeavor. It involves new curriculum, new instructional materials, teacher training, assessments, a whole bevy of stuff that goes along with changing standards. And it's something for the California State Board to consider, is what's going to be the transition cost. And if there are, like Daniela said, their student achievement isn't great, right? So if there are ways that they can raise student achievement, like if there is great curricula out there being developed, there are high quality instructional materials, there's really high quality teacher training out there that's going to perhaps improve student achievement with somewhat mediocre standards, that's perhaps a decent trade-off for good standards but poor achievement. So they have to look at the infrastructure that and the benefits that might come along with adopting the new standards. They also have to look at things like cost and how long it's going to take, and, you know, moving the mountain of transitioning might not be worth it if they're transitioning to standards that aren't as good.
I mean, another point is that right now California is knee-deep in Common Core implementation along with the other 45 plus states there, and do they have the bandwidth to adopt and then implement three new content specific sets of standards? Do they have the bandwidth to do all of that? Or is this, you know, are they going to throw out the Common Core with the ingest bathwater, so to speak?
Right. And I hope that the state board is bringing in teachers and principals and superintendents and teachers and teachers
and teachers
and teachers to talk about the way that Common Core is being implemented and to talk about the way that science is currently being taught so that they get an on the ground level look at whether adopting the new standards are even feasible, let alone a good idea.
Good point. Pamela, question number three.
Coursera, a MOOC provider, has raised another $43 million in venture capital. The company now works with 83 educational institutions on four continents. There's been talk of expanding these online courses into the K-12 arena. As former teachers, what do you think?
Let me qualify this by saying, as a former math teacher, I think it's fine that math is an extremely proficiency-based subject. It's basically, if you can pass the final exam in a comprehensive final exam in a course, how much does it really matter that you spent every day in the classroom, that you spent a certain number of hours with your body in the chair? If you can pass the final exam and demonstrate proficiency in math, then more power to you. That's what the goal is. And so I think that MOOCs, as long as they come with a high quality end of course exam for math, it's an opportunity for students who don't do well in a traditional classroom. And as a former teacher, I can assure you that there are many such students.
Well, and there's the two points of it too, right? Is the digital learning itself and having virtual classrooms or blended learning approaches and things like that versus MOOCs. And so I think students who don't do well in the traditional classroom might do fantastically with MOOCs, or might find that a blended learning approach or a different type of virtual school model might better serve them. That said, I think there's no harm in increasing the amount of potential education that students can have. MOOCs can really be useful as supplemental programs, potentially to supplant specific maybe math classes or things, but really we shouldn't be assuming that the MOOC will be the only type of education delivery, or that a student can't go home and access a new, really interesting, novel, different course that they wouldn't have access to in their rural school, in their urban school. Heck, I went to a suburban school. I had English 1 through 4, and that was it. If I wanted to read or learn or anything else about, you know, more than that, that was on my own to figure out. And MOOCs might be great for students who just want that extra amount of knowledge.
And I think also, I was very specific in saying math classes, because when you're talking about MOOC, the M stands for massive. And it's a lot easier to standardize a math test and judge proficiency on a math test, multiple choice math exam, than it is when you're talking about an English class, skills like reading and writing and analysis. And there's only so much that you can get from a multiple choice test. And there's only so much that you can get with extremely limited interaction and access to discussion when you're talking about taking apart a text. You need to talk to other people. You need to interact with other people. So I think, you know, tentatively, let's talk about it for supplemental. And if we're going to use it for credit bearing or to determine proficiency, be really, really careful and don't just throw everyone in and say, here you go, you're going to get credit without any sort of oversight.
Good point. Yeah, no, it should not be an across the subjects sort of thing. All right, that is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Thanks for playing, Dara.
Anytime.
And now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Danielle.
How are you doing? How was your fourth?
Great. My fourth was, I stayed home and watched fireworks on TV.
Yes. Love it.
That's what happens when you get a little older and you do not want to fight the crowds.
You know,
and you're happy because you got your popcorn, you got your glass of wine, and all is good with the world.
You got your air conditioning.
And your air conditioning.
It's not 115 degrees out. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
One time on the downtown mall is enough. Just one time.
The trick is you go to the backside of the Capitol building where the Library of Congress is. Mm. You can sit on the steps of the Library of Congress. You watch the fireworks from over the Capitol building. The crowds are all on the west side, but you're on the east side. Mm. And maybe you put a glass of wine in your thermos. It's still a little hot out, though.
All right.
Well, I'll say, Dare, you've come over to the East Coast. Obviously, you hear East Side, Best Side, West Side. No go. All right. Amber, what do you have for us today?
We have a new report out by AIR and SRI called Early College, Early Success. It examines the impact of the early college high schools, which a lot of people are familiar with. These allow students who are traditionally underrepresented in college the opportunity to take college-bearing courses in high school and receive credit, similar to the dual enrollment, but not exactly. There are roughly 240 of these schools nationally. They serve about 75,000 students in 28 states. They usually partner with a college to offer the curriculum for students, and the college professor and the teacher co-deliver and co-design the course. So just a little background. Analysts use a randomized control design by exploring the lottery-based admissions of 10 of these schools, so small number, examining the difference between roughly 2,500 students who won and lost the lottery. They use a bunch of local and state administrative data. They use a student clearinghouse data, which can track these students. For three ninth grade cohorts, they looked at high school graduations, college enrollment, and college graduation. The key finding, students who were involved in early college did significantly better on all three outcomes than those who lost the lottery. Just a little factoid, 77% of students admitted into the early college had enrolled in college 1 year after high school, compared to 67% of the comparison group, which I still thought was kind of high for the comparison group. In a similar vein, 20% of early college students had earned a post-secondary degree. That was usually, obviously, an associate's degree by the end of high school, compared to 1% of the comparison group, again, to be expected. And the impact of the early college initiative was strongest for poor and minority students, which we see again and again in other similar initiatives. Then they did a student survey. They asked them to try to pick up some of the contextual differences between the two groups. And the early college kids said they had more help completing college applications. There was a stronger college-going culture in their school. It was more rigorous academics, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, it's good news for the Gates Foundation, which supports these schools a lot better than the tons of money they put in the small schools initiative 10 or so years ago, probably longer than that now. So good news. You know, I think that they refined kind of what would be high impact for disadvantaged kids, and this one seems really promising. And what I thought, hey, by the way, these kids are saving 2 years of college tuition, which is a very big deal these days.
I've heard nothing but good things about these types of programs, which begs the question, why are there not more of them? Mm-hmm. I mean, is this scalable? Is it a question of cost, resources?
Yeah, so I dug into some of the FAQs about these, and they say on average there were 7 to 12% more than a typical high school to operate, which doesn't strike me as excessive. You know, I don't know how if these college professors are doing this as part of their outreach. You know, it could be part of, you know, that part of the check the box in terms of what you do as a professor, which would help obviously with the cost. I mean, a lot of college professors, particularly in the curriculum instruction department, want to be involved in schools and obviously want their students to be involved in schools. So it seems like it would be, you know, fairly inexpensive to run compared to other initiatives. But it looks like I don't know if you know more about this than I do, Dare, but it looks like they are dedicated school buildings. In other words, they're not in a wing of a traditional high school. They are the freestanding. I don't know whether that's important to the design or not.
I mean, it could just be a question of cost, where if you mm-hmm. have a freestanding campus, then you have all the costs associated with that, and you can't share costs with a main campus, so it's not like a magnet school that's co-located with a traditional high school. But
that's right. I mean, incidentally, we have one of these that we work with in Dayton, the DECA. Dayton Early College Academy, which continues to excel and do well and just gets highlighted all the time. So, this is promising stuff. I'm like, let's do more.
I think, Amber, that's exactly right. I mean, we've seen great things out of DECA. And, I mean, Trekker's book recently, even about selective public high schools, found that there just aren't enough of kind of any of these schools that are going to service students who really want to move forward on their own education at the high school level.
Which is why it's not surprising that you still had a high number of grads who didn't go to the early mm-hmm. college mm-hmm. high school graduating from high school, because even if you're entering a lottery for these programs, you have to have information about that the program even exists in the first place. And so you'd imagine that even the group that didn't get in is academically motivated, at least.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And they begin to see, hey, this is doable. You know, I mean, this is not an impossible thing to do. And yeah, absolutely. I think it's a, I think there's a psychological element here, too, that, you know, this is accessible and this is, college is not out of reach.
It's true. There's a big difference between needing to go for 2 extra years versus needing to go for 4.
That's right.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us today, Amber. That's all the time we have. Until next week.
I'm Darizy Handelar.
And I'm Daniela Fairchild of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.